Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin and go to the UK to speak with David Patrikarakos, a journalist and a fellow at the Institute of Iranian Studies at the University of St. Andrews. We'll discuss the possibility of reintegrating Iran into the international fold and a strategic realignment in the Middle East following the nuclear deal with the P5+1, as well as David Patrikarakos' recent article in the New York Times, Iran, From Enemy to Ally. Then we'll speak with writer, journalist, and professor Mark Denner about his provocative and widely read article in the New York Review of Books, Rumsfeld's War and Its Consequences Now, and the new film about Rumsfeld by Errol Morris. Mark Denner teaches at the University of California, Berkeley, and at Bard College, and is the author of The Secret Way to War, The Downing Street Memo and the Iraq War's Buried History, and Torture and Truth, America's Abu Ghraib and the War on Terror. Then finally, after months of unnecessary delay, financial regulators today voted to finalize the Volcker Rule, a key provision required by the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act. Micah Hauptmann, the Financial Policy Council at Public Citizens Congress Watch Division, joins us to discuss the Volcker Rule's implementation after fierce lobbying by the banks and whether or not the five big banks who dominate the $300 trillion domestic derivatives market will be reined in or find ways around the new law. And joining us now is David Patrikarakos, who is a journalist and an associate fellow at the Institute of Iranian Studies at the University of St. Andrews. He is the author of Nuclear Iran, The Birth of an Atomic State, and he has an op-ed in the New York Times, Iran from Enemy to Ally. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Patrikarakos.
Hi there, Ian.
And David, when you talk about the idea that Iran can transform from an enemy into an ally, I guess we have to take into account John Kerry's recent remarks, where he, of course, was involved with these very negotiations that brought about this hope and this thaw in this frozen and hostile relationship that's gone on since 1979. Kerry himself is basically saying, given the history, we are all rightly skeptical about whether people are ready to make the hard choices to live up to this deal. So that's what he's telling the U.S. Congress. And as you know, the U.S. Congress is poised to even vote stiffer sanctions, which would, in effect, scuttle the deal.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's a very, very complex issue. And when I talk about transforming from an enemy into an ally, in my op-ed, I do stress that this is very much a long-term goal. It's not around the corner. It's not going to happen overnight. But I think what is clear is that over 30 years of not talking to the Islamic Republic hasn't worked. It hasn't succeeded in moderating their behavior. And it simply was, you know, a wrong policy in the end. I mean, a few years ago, I was part of a team that interviewed Nick Burns at Harvard in Boston. And he made the point that throughout the Cold War, the U.S. had an embassy in Moscow. They'd even spoken to the North Koreans, but they hadn't spoken to the Americans. Now, the recent deal is only an interim deal. It's only the very, very start, but let's hope that it is the beginning of some sort of rapprochement, because I think this is needed for both the U.S. and for Iran, but it's going to be tough.
Well, of course, that was one of the ironies of the Axis of Evil speech under George W. Bush, that the three countries he named in the Axis of Evil, Iraq, Iran, and North Korea, none of them we have any diplomatic presence in any of these countries. And so we have to rely on overhead intelligence and other people's embassies. And by not talking to people and by casting them as pariahs, in a curious way, you not only do you cut off contacts, but you also cut off intelligence.
You do. But the interesting thing is that by making the Islamic Republic pariah, in many ways, it strengthened the hardliners in Iran. Now, you know, the Ayatollah Khamenei and the hardliners grouped around him, they based their legitimacy on resisting the great Satan. So actually, Obama's attempt at detente in 2008, when he came to power, was very, very problematic for them because, you know, they couldn't very well say the great Satan was trying to destroy Iran when he wanted to shake their hands. Conversely, actually, the aggressive rhetoric of the Bush administration was a bit of a godsend for the mullahs. So I think actually that, you know, reaching out to Iran, trying to achieve some kind of deal, does strengthen the moderates there, and I think that's very important.
And David Patrikarakos, your recent piece in the New York Times, Iran from Enemy to Ally, you point out that in 2003, fearing American military action, Iran reached out via the Swiss to American officials. I've spoken with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who was Compound's chief of staff, who was in the White House at the time. And he basically said that the Iranians were putting everything on the table because they were afraid that they'd be next after Saddam was toppled. But that Dick Cheney basically said, we don't talk to evil, and that was the end of it. Is that your understanding?
That is my understanding. I mean, a lot of controversy does surround this. I spoke to John Bolton, and he said that it never happened. But I have heard exactly what you have heard, and that phrase keeps coming back to me, we don't talk to evil. I think, given what has happened subsequently, that it was an error, and an unfortunate one at that, and I think we'd be in a much better position had that deal been accepted. But the point I was making in my op-ed is that the Iranians will compromise. Now, you need to put pressure on them. They're not going to give things up easily. And the only reason they're at the negotiating table now is because of the sanctions, which are really, really scorching the Iranian economy. You know, the mullahs are in trouble. But, you know, 30 years of economic mismanagement has now been accentuated by these oil and banking sanctions. When you hit Iran's oil, its primary source of foreign exchange earnings, you really hit them where it hurts. So the sanctions have been effective. You do need to apply pressure. I think it's about taking that pressure now and seeing that we can, trying to move as far forward as we possibly can.
Again, I'm speaking with David Patrikarakos, who's a journalist and associate fellow at the Institute of Iranian Studies at the University of St. Andrews. He is the author of Nuclear Iran, The Birth of an Atomic State, and he has an op-ed at the New York Times, Iran from Enemy to Ally. So it's not that long ago, as you point out in your op-ed, that in the 1970s, Iran and Saudi Arabia formed Richard M. Nixon's twin pillar strategies to counter Soviet influence in the region. You're also suggesting here that if Iran were to basically come back into the fold, then that could check Chinese access to critical energy. It could affect what's happening in Lebanon with Hezbollah and in Israel and the Palestinian territories with Hamas, and then also in terms of the Syrian civil war, which won't be ended, to your mind, and without Iran's participation. I've talked to a few specialists who said in many ways that it is that the isolation that Iran feels that's driven to this point. But is there any evidence that they're prepared to give up their position in any way? Because the difference between the Iranians and the Russians' support for Assad and the ambivalent support that the Americans and the Europeans have had towards the Syrian rebels is pretty stark, is it not?
Yes, I would agree with that. I mean, Syria is a difficult case. I mean, you know, my thoughts on that are that, you know, Iran's influence in Syria, if they can't be convinced to use their influence positively, then at least involving them might get them to use it less negatively. Now, it is very difficult because I think that the Iranians consider the fall of Assad an existential threat. So I'm not really sure what you could do, really. I think that's just a case where they just have completely different interests. You know, I think on Hezbollah, on Hamas, these sorts of things that they did put up for debate before, you could get a lot of traction, you could get a lot of mileage out of that. And the key that I keep coming back to is this, is that Iran, you have to deal with Iran. It's 70 million people. It geostrategically sits between the Caspian Sea and the Persian Gulf. It's on the Straits of Hormuz. It's critically important. It's huge, huge oil and national gas supplier. You have to deal with Iran. Keeping it boxed up, keeping it isolated, keeping it artificially weak cannot last forever. So let's engage with them as best we can. Obviously, let's not be too soft. Let them get away with stalling even more on the nuclear program. But we have to engage Iran. For 30 years, we didn't, and it didn't work. It didn't moderate their behavior. It didn't make anything better. And I think now is the time to move forward.
But conversely, while we have isolated Iran, we have embraced the Saudis. And the Saudis acted as the key in terms of oil prices because of their surplus capacity. They can affect oil prices. And is there a concern in the West with the U.S. and with Israel and certainly with the Saudis that if Iran, which has a lot of influence in Iraq, thanks to George W. Bush, Cheney, Rice and Rumsfeld boneheaded invasion of Iraq, all that ended up doing was in effect, you know, handing over Iraq to Iran, there's no question that Iran has enormous influence over Iraq.
If you combine the massive oil reserves in Iraq with Iran's oil reserves, you have a much, much more powerful oil player than Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I think the relationship with Saudi Arabia, you know, was built on oil. There doesn't quite, you know, a need for oil, a U.S. need for oil, a Western need for oil, it doesn't quite exist to the same degree. I mean, especially thanks to new fracking technologies, the U.S. is becoming a huge, huge source of oil itself. Now, it doesn't mean that the Saudis can't affect oil markets. Of course they can. But I think that their, you know, their influence is perhaps slightly waning. And I think they, you know, there's serious problems with the Saudis. Their funding of Salafist and jihadist groups has caused huge problems for U.S. interests, for Western interests across the globe. And for, you know, for Muslims across the globe who have suffered as a result. Don't forget that the primary targets of these forces are other Muslims. So I do think that it could be time to see a slight shift or emphasis away from the Saudis, not necessarily towards the Iranians immediately, but just perhaps to start trying to sort of recalibrate various relationships in the Middle East.
But while the Saudis do have this duplicitous role where they fund Wahhabi extremism that's manifests itself all around the globe, and they are funding the al-Nusra and the extreme elements in Syria, they're saying that it's not the government, it's wealthy Saudi individuals that are doing it. But that's a little hard to swallow, is it not, given how tightly the al-Sauds run that country with their ubiquitous intelligence service and, of course, the religious police?
Well, look, one can't say for certain, but I do agree broadly with what you're saying. You know, I think that, I mean, okay, you get rogue elements like bin Laden, of course, but I think by and large, the country is pretty tightly run, especially when you think how large the royal family is, about 5,000 members, all of whom have their own little groups who are dependent on them for patronage. It's a very tribal, very interconnected system. So I would agree with what you say, yes.
Well, but the further point would be then that the Saudis, if their role in funding the Taliban, obviously al-Qaeda came out of Saudi Arabia, they've also funded madrasas, etc., in Pakistan that pushed that country towards a, well, shall we say it's to some extent destabilized Pakistan. That's the role of petrodollars in terms of funding radicalism. Is there a potential on the Iranian side, if they get their oil up and running and if they could also have influence over Iraqi oil, would the same threat exist? Because under Ahmadinejad and other radical groups, they did fund radical groups around the world. They appear to have backed off a little on that, but does the potential exist?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, look, they're big funders of Hamas, they're big funders of Hezbollah. Yeah, they're huge funders of radical groups. It's slightly different, and I think it's more political rather than ideological. I mean, certainly Hezbollah is Shia as well, but Hamas obviously isn't. And I think that these are sort of geostrategic power plays as they push and fight for influence in the region. And I think that they're generally slightly more pragmatic about it. I mean, you know, the sort of days of wanting to export the Shia revolution, you know, of 1979 are long gone. It was pretty much burned out of them during the Iran-Iraq war. So I think it's slightly different in tenor, but absolutely, Iran, you know, Iran funds pretty unpleasant groups. But this is my point, you know. I mean, how do you stop them doing it? How do you try to stop them doing it? Well, it hasn't, you know, you haven't stopped them doing it for the last 20 years. But as you say, in 2003, they promised, you know, they offered it on the table. They were going to potentially discuss giving it up or at least putting it on the table to discuss. So, you know, that's the sort of way to go, I think, you know, bring them to the table. Use whatever leverage you can, integrate them in slowly and over time without being naive, because I know that this is the criticism often thrown at Obama. But I think, and I keep saying it, you know, now is the time to engage. And I'll repeat myself again, 30 years of not talking achieved nothing. You have to move forward. It is complex. Iran does a lot of very unpleasant things. But it's just, you know, a question of working towards lessening some of those unpleasant things. And I believe the way to do that is to talk to them.
But as much as Obama is getting pushback from the U.S. Congress, who are threatening to scuttle the deal by ramping up the sanctions on Iran, which would be a deal breaker, it's pretty clear from Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu where Israel stands. He's been against any kind of rapprochement with the Islamic Republic, and as even there have been rumors of a military strike for the longest time. But what's interesting in your article is you point out the extent to which Israel and the Iranians have always had a fairly close relationship. So Walk us through that, and because I'm trying to understand how you're in effect arguing that maybe Netanyahu doesn't see the forest from the trees. Is that what you're saying?
I think to a degree you're right, yes. I mean, look, as I say in the article, Iran is a Persian Shia state and Israel is a Jewish state. Both of them are outsiders. They're predominantly Sunni Arab Middle East. Both are subject to isolation. This happened to Iran during the Iran-Iraq war, when pretty much all the Arab states, apart from Syria, sided with Saddam. And it's happened to Israel since its founding, over 60 years ago. You know, they were allies under the Shah of Iran before the Ayatollah Khomeini came in the 1979 revolution. Israel and Iran were discrete allies. That would not have been possible at that time between Israel and any other Arab state. Iran took part in none of the wars against Israel. It's never lost any territory to Israel. And they, in fact, have a convergence of interest. And don't forget that even after the Islamic Revolution, when all the fiery anti-Israeli rhetoric began, that Israel and Iran still cooperated. Between 1980 and 1983, Israel sold Iran $500 million worth of weapons in its fight against Iraq. They provided advice, military advice, all these sorts of things. And, you know, during the early 1980s, when Iran was in disgrace with Washington, in rightful disgrace with Washington, following its disgraceful seizure of U.S. diplomats during the hostage crisis, Israel lobbied for Iran in the early 80s, you know, despite the rhetoric that was coming out of Tehran. I mean, you have to understand a lot of what's behind the rhetoric, which is, you know, the Iranians are Persian Shias. When it comes to the Palestinians, they don't really care that much about the suffering of Sunni Arabs. I've been into Iran, been around it, the people don't really care. Conversely, when I go to the Arab world, it's a very, very sore issue. But Iran, again, is always isolated in the Middle East. So what it does is it ramps up the rhetoric. It proclaims itself a self-proclaimed champion of the Palestinians. And it receives a lot of credit on the quote-unquote Arab street. So Arab governments have to be very, you know, slightly more careful about criticizing Iran because of this, because they're, you know, fearful of their own populations. I mean, one of the interesting things was, for years, you know, I was speaking to Arabs, and they were terrified of an Iranian bomb, terrified of an Iranian bomb, far more scared than they are of an Israeli bomb, when, you know, Israel has nuclear weapons. But they wouldn't say it publicly. You know, publicly, they couldn't be seen to be criticizing Iran and therefore almost, if you like, siding with Israel. Iran has done this very, very cleverly.
Well, I think to buttress what you're saying, Sheikh Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah, became a hero for not – obviously, he didn't win the last war against Israel, but he still was standing when the war was over, and he became a hero on the Arab street. But my understanding is that, you know, the pendulum has swung in the opposite direction because of Hezbollah's involvement on the side of the Alawite regime of Assad in Syria.
Absolutely.
So perhaps that's basically moderating Iran's position vis-a-vis the Palestinians, because the Palestinians themselves are having second thoughts, aren't they?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I reported from Lebanon a couple of years ago, and, you know, it's a big problem because, you know, before the Lebanese were the champion of the underdog, you know, in the Arab, you know, in the Arab world's eyes. And now, you know, they're certainly not the champion of the underdog anymore when they're helping Assad to butcher his own people. I mean, the last 10 years has been sort of up and down for Iran. As you rightly say, you know, in 2001, the Americans removed the Taliban, one of Iran's most pressing security concerns. 2003, they removed Saddam, Iran's other most pressing security concern. They recalibrated the Middle East in Iran's favor. But recently, things have been changing. You know, the problems with Assad is a big problem for Iran. They're very, very worried that if Assad falls, it's going to be bad news for the Iranians. They're losing a lot of legitimacy in the Arab world through their own help of Assad. If it wasn't for the Iranians, Assad would have fallen a long time ago. Their proxy group, Hezbollah, is now losing legitimacy in the Arab world. So these last couple of years have not been good for Iran. And it comes back to my point as to why they're at the table. On top of what I've just said, they have huge sanctions against them, and they're more isolated than at any other time in the history of the Islamic Republic since the Iran-Iraq war. They're in trouble.
Well, David Patrikarakos, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with David Patrikarakos, who's a journalist and associate fellow at the Institute of Iranian Studies at the University of St. Andrews. He is the author of Nuclear Iran, The Birth of an Atomic State, and he has an op-ed in the New York Times, Iran from Enemy to Ally. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with Mark Denner about his provocative and widely read new article in the New York Review of Books, Rumsfeld's War and Its Consequences Now.